This is VOA News. I'm Marissa Melton. Some 400 medical experts are meeting online and in person in Geneva, Switzerland, to come up with a way to fight the deadly coronavirus. The latest reports put the number of confirmed cases at more than 42,000 and the number of deaths at more than 1,000, mostly inside China. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the outbreak is a test of humanity's willingness to work together.
It's a test of political solidarity, whether the world can come together to fight a common enemy that does not respect borders or ideologies.
At a briefing on the coronavirus, Executive Director Michael Ryan says there's no evidence to support claims the virus could wreak global havoc.
When we look at disease outside China, we're dealing with less than 400 cases in 24 countries in over a month of transmission. Now, that does not mean that that won't escalate. It doesn't mean that that won't accelerate. But that is not, in that sense, an insurmountable problem.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has an early lead in the New Hampshire Democratic primary. It's the first Democratic primary of the 2020 presidential race.
Let us go forward. Let us have the largest voter turnout in the history of the New Hampshire primary. Let's win this thing. Let's transform America.
First returns give Sanders 28% of the vote. That was his voice you just heard, followed by former South Bend, Indiana mayor Pete Buttigieg with 23%. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar is third with 21% so far. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has 10% so far. Two candidates who are trailing behind, entrepreneur Andrew Yang and Colorado Senator Michael Bennett, announced on Tuesday they'll be dropping out of the race. You can find more on these and other stories online at voanews.com. From Washington, D.C., you're listening to VOA News. The United Nations Humanitarian Affairs Agency said Tuesday that nearly 700,000 civilians have been displaced by a renewed Russia-backed Syrian government offensive against the rebel-held northwest since early December. Speaking at a UN regular briefing on Tuesday, a spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, said the offensive has caused the largest number of people displaced in a single period since the beginning of the conflict 9 years ago.
In just little more than 10 weeks from the 1st of December till today, nearly 700,000 people have been forcibly displaced in Idlib and surrounding areas in northwest Syria, most of them women and children.
The agency's statements came as government forces seized control of a highway in northwest Syria for the first time since 2012 on Tuesday as they pressed their campaign to eradicate the last rebel strongholds in Idlib province and in the Aleppo countryside. Sudan's ruling council has agreed to hand over former President Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court. The government says it's part of efforts to achieve justice and sustain peace in the Darfur region. Nabah Mohideen reports from Khartoum.
Sovereign Council member Mohamed Taishi addressed reporters Tuesday in South Sudan's capital. Ataishi says they agreed to put everyone who has arrest warrants on trial at the ICC. Ataishi adds it's not possible to achieve justice unless it's cured the pain with justice itself. He says they can't deny that crimes against humanity and war crimes were committed against innocence in Darfur. It was not immediately clear when Bashir or other three Sudanese nationals wanted by the ICC might be handed over. A member of the Rebel Justice and Equality Movement told VOA on Tuesday that the government and Darfur rebels must first reach a final peace agreement. Nabah Mohideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
Lebanese security forces Tuesday clashed with protesters near the parliament building in downtown Beirut. Reuters' Lucy Fielder has more.
Crowds tried to stop lawmakers even reaching the heavily barricaded parliament. But the session went ahead as riot police fired tear gas at demonstrators calling for new elections. Hundreds were injured. Protesters accused Lebanon's successive governments of entrenched corruption and decades of state waste, the roots of a financial crisis made worse by months of unrest. And the new government, they say, is no different. Prime Minister Hassan Diab, who took office last month, called for painful steps to address the crisis and for Lebanon to seek foreign help.
That's Reuters' Lucy Fielder reporting. I'm Marissa Melton. This is VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan's government and Darfur rebels reach a deal that could send former President Bashir to the International Criminal Court.
Attaché says they agreed to put everyone who has arrest warrants on trial at the ICC. He says they can't deny that crimes against humanity were committed against innocents in Darfur.
That's reporter Namba Muhyiddin in Khartoum. We have analysis of what some are calling a surprising deal. Malawi's government warns politicians against making inflammatory statements. Civilians flee worsening conditions in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. And the African Union has concluded this year's summit with a pledge to play a greater role in ending conflicts on the continent.
It would be useful if the African Union Peace and Security Council was to put the Anglophone crisis on its agenda. This would signal that the continent was very serious about the problem.
Elisa Jobson is the director of Africa Regional Advocacy for the International Crisis Group, and the body of former Kenyan President Daniel Arap Moi will be laid to rest today, Wednesday. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan's ruling council has agreed to hand over former President Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court. The movement says the decision is part of efforts to achieve justice and sustain peace in the Darfur region. Namba Muhyiddin reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's ruling sovereign council says it has agreed with Darfur rebel groups on four mechanisms to sustain peace in Darfur. Handing over former President Omar al-Bashir and three top aides to the International Criminal Court is the first one. Sovereign Council member Mohamed Attaché addressed reporters Tuesday in South Sudan's capital. Attaché says they agreed to put everyone who has arrest warrants on trial at the ICC. Attaché adds it's not possible to achieve justice unless it's cured the pain with justice itself. He says they can't deny that crimes against humanity and war crimes were committed against innocents in Darfur. Bashir and other officials from the former ruling party have been in prison since the military ousted Bashir last April. A Sudanese court has sentenced Bashir to 2 years' detention on corruption charges. But many Sudanese demanded Bashir and other former high officials be sent to the ICC. The court in The Hague has charged Bashir with war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide for his government's action during the war in Sudan's Darfur region. Pro-Bashir forces allegedly tried to destroy entire ethnic groups as they battled a rebellion in Darfur that began in 2003. The Joint Military Civilian Sovereign Council established last August has been negotiating with rebels to put an end to the long-running war. It was not immediately clear when Bashir or other three Sudanese nationals wanted by the ICC might be handed over. A member of the Rebel Justice and Equality Movement told VOA on Tuesday that the government and Darfur rebels must first reach a final peace agreement. Namba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
For analysis of the news from Sudan, we turn to Brian Adeba, Deputy Director of Policy at the Enough Project. He says the new Sudan government has demonstrated a serious commitment to human rights principles.
I think it's very courageous of the young government in Khartoum to take the measure that it did. In Africa, there has been no government that has been amenable to handing over people accused of war crimes to the ICC. So this is significant and very different and takes a lot of courage to do that, and it's very commendable.
This transitional government in Khartoum is made up of military and civilians. Do you really think that this will happen, that Mr. Bashir will be sent to the ICC?
Yeah, that's a good question to ask. Even if you read the news reports coming out about the issue, it seems like there is still some negotiation or some hurdles to cross. Nevertheless, the spokesman who broke the news to the media said that this was a decision of government, meaning the military junta who were formerly with Bashir and also the civilian government. So there is maybe principally an agreement on the issue. It remains to be seen how the next hurdles will be overcome, but it looks like from a top-level perspective, there is already a decision. So that's positive.
Do you think this decision was reached because the new government wants some economic support from the outside?
Well, if you look at the hurdles to economic support to Sudan at this particular point, they have nothing to do with Bashir as a person. They have to do with issues like state sponsor of terrorism, Sudan being on that list, and then the after effects of a kleptocracy, a corrupt government in power. So those are some of the hurdles to Sudan to get access to international funding. Bashir has nothing to do with it. But what it really does signify is that there is popular will also across the country really to have Bashir put on trial. And then the other issue, though, is his former comrades are also in government. And putting him on trial in Sudan will unearth a lot of other issues that may be detrimental to his former comrades. And so the best way then is really to get him out of the country and have him tried at the ICC. And it's a popular demand. So those could be factors at play here.
You know, the ICC has come under criticism, and that is of UNE targeting Africans. In fact, some people argue there are more Bashirs somewhere in Africa and in other countries around the world that could go before the ICC. The African Union, I think, have said maybe that people like Bashir should be tried in their own national courts. What do you make of that?
I think that the other thing then is to really look at the competency and the political will to try culprits in African courts. And a lot of time, the people that are accused of mass atrocities are very powerful people. They have very powerful friends. They have vast patronage networks within the country, and that really makes it impossible to try them within the country. And that's one thing that the African governments may have to look at and try to reform their systems, hopefully, to create a conducive atmosphere for trying culprits at home.
Brian Adeba is the Deputy Director of Policy at the Enough Project. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. The African Union has concluded this year's summit in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, with a pledge to play a greater role in ending conflicts on the continent. The theme of this year's summit was silencing the guns, creating conducive conditions for Africa's development. Ahead of the summit, the International Crisis Group wrote an article praising the AU for its efforts in Sudan and the Central African Republic. But the group said the African Union failed to prevent other conflicts. It identified 8 areas where it said the AU, under the leadership of new chairperson and South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, can focus. Elissa Jobson is Director of Africa Regional Advocacy for the International Crisis Group. She says the AU must assert itself to keep South Sudan's floundering peace process on track.
One of the things that we've seen throughout the conflict there is that in order for things to move, there needs to be concerted action at the highest level. So the presidents of IGAD need to engage. And the African Union can encourage and put pressure on the leaders to do that. I think also what would be useful to ensure that the AU has eyes and ears on the ground and is a bigger part of the process would be for the African Union to appoint its own envoy who could potentially help IGAD with the mediation and shuttle between the two leaders, Machar and Kiir.
You also talk about how the African Union can help the Paul Biya government in Cameroon and the separatists towards a dialogue to end the conflict. Once again, how can this take place? After all, this has been tried before.
Yes, I agree that there has been attempts to bring the separatists and the government in Cameroon to dialogue, and they haven't been successful. But I think that we haven't seen the international community, and that includes the African Union, doing everything they can to bring pressure to bear on both the Cameroonian government and the separatists to engage in an inclusive dialogue. I think that it would be useful if the African Union Peace and Security Council was to put the Anglophone crisis on its agenda. This would signal that the continent was very serious about the problem, and I think it would also concentrate thinking in Cameroon. In addition, it would make it easier for the UN Security Council to discuss the crisis, which would add more pressure to both parties to come to the table. So much more concerted and coordinated public pressure on both the government in Yaoundé and the separatists could encourage them to come to dialogue.
One of the areas is deterring Cote d'Ivoire and Guinea from using constitutional amendments to hold on to power. Is this possible?
In recent years, the African Union has set a norm against military takeovers, military coups. So I think it could be possible for the African Union to actually deter its own members from using constitutional amendments to hold on to power. And this year, we're seeing in Cote d'Ivoire and Guinea attempts by leaders to stay in power by changing the rules. Ideally, the AU would decide to suspend member states that alter constitutions in the same way that it suspends those that engage in military coups. That's a very bold step, and it's not something that we would be likely to see. However, I do think that the African Union could much more easily, and particularly the leaders, could encourage their peers, whether in public or private, to persuade them not to change the rules so that they can run again. We saw that quiet pressure from Angola and South Africa was instrumental in ensuring that Joseph Kabila did not stand for a third term in 2018.
Elisa Jobson is the director of Africa Regional Advocacy for the International Crisis Group. She was speaking with us from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Today is Wednesday, February 12th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. The Malawian government has condemned Eisenhower Mkaka, General Secretary of the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, the MCP, for describing MCP presidential candidate Lazarus Chakwera and his wife as president and first lady, respectively, during a recent campaign rally in the capital, Lilongwe. Information Minister Mark Botomani says the pronouncement by the MCP General Secretary is shameful and an affront to the Constitution. He says Malawians recognize incumbent President Arthur Mutharika as the legitimate president of the country. Botomani tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the government is cautioning political leaders to stop making inflammatory remarks that could create tension and possible violence.
We thought those remarks were very, very serious and unfortunate because the Constitutional Court held the fact that this country has a president and in the name of Professor Arthur Mutharika, and of course by extension, Professor Arthur Mutharika. So those remarks were very serious and not in order.
What do you say to critics who say that the reaction and condemnation from the government appears to be over the top and that this was just a campaign rhetoric which does not necessarily create any tension or disaffection among the population at all?
Peter, one thing that you need to understand, we're not in the campaign period because there is an appeal that has been made by respondents to the case, and that is President Peter Mutharika and the Malawi Electoral Commission. And the Malawi Electoral Commission itself has not declared that we are in a campaign period. So if some quarters think that those are just mere campaign rhetoric, then they are missing the point.
Your statement further went ahead to accuse the MCP of fomenting trouble or violence in their decision not to condemn what the General Secretary said. Why would you attribute such a strong word to a political party that many say have been peaceful in their challenge of the outcome of the presidential election so far?
First of all, we bemoaned the choice of the venue for holding that particular rally because in our view, it was not right to hold a rally at that particular place because this is a place which is synonymous of violence. I'm sure you have been following what has been happening. That place called Msundwe is the one that has been at the peak of violence all this time during demonstrations. And as you know, we lost a police officer who was stoned on duty right that place. So we felt that the choice of going there to have a rally itself was more or less like inciting violence.
One of the commissioners of the Malawi Electoral Commission said they are yet to begin preparations for the upcoming elections ordered by the Constitutional Court, although the outcome is being challenged by the president at the Supreme Court. Is this a concern to the government that the Malawi Electoral Commission has yet to officially begin any preparation at all to organize an election ordered by the Constitutional Court?
The ruling at the Constitutional Court only came on the 3rd of February. And obviously, I'm not sure how you would have expected the Malawi Electoral Commission to quickly sit down and start planning for the next election. You know that the court gave about 150 days, but the Malawi Electoral Commission itself says they need at least over 260 days in order for them to properly organize a credible election process. So it's really something that we need to reflect on. And of course, as you know, that there's a challenge already in court that is challenging the verdict that came out from court.
Mark Botomani Kimani is Malawi's information minister. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Lilongwe. Civilians have fled worsening conditions in Democratic Republic of Congo's eastern Benin territory over the past 2 months. The UNHCR says the attacks by armed groups in the so-called Watalinga chiefdom near the border with Uganda have sent thousands of people fleeing for their lives. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Attacks on villages and towns by armed groups in Congo's lawless eastern borderland have been rising since December. This has prompted mass flight by the residents to the town of Nobili and surrounding areas. The UN Refugee Agency says many of those fleeing previously had been displaced. They had fled violence in April and only just returned to their villages in November. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahechich says the displaced are in dire need of assistance.
Tensions in the region have been rising since the launch of the government-led military operation in December against the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF. Civilians, including those displaced in November and December, are among those targeted by armed groups, including the ADF. Many people told UNHCR staff that they now live in fear after witnessing killings, sexual violence, and abductions.
The ADF, a Ugandan Islamist group, is one of many armed groups vying for influence in the region. Local authorities estimate 252 civilians have been killed in Beni territory since December. Mahechich says the majority of those who have fled to Nobili are being sheltered by local host communities. Others, he says, are crammed into schools and churches.
Thousands more are living in dire conditions across 100 or so informal settlements, sleeping in huts made of branches. They're also exposed to elements and face serious threats to their safety, protection, including the lack of privacy.
Mahechich says the vast majority of displaced persons are women and children in urgent need of basic assistance and protection. He says food, shelter, water, sanitation, and hygiene are scarce, and thousands of homeless children have little or no access to education. More than 5 million people are displaced in DRC, the largest number in Africa. The UNHCR says money is scarce to care for this huge population of internally displaced. The agency says the international community has donated only 4% of the $150 million it needs to assist millions of refugees and internally displaced in Congo this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A French appeals court has confirmed a sentence against Equatorial Guinea vice president for embezzling money from Equatorial Guinea and purchasing luxury items in France under French anti-money laundering laws. The court this week confirmed it will fine vice president Theodore Obiang $33 million U.S. dollars and giving him 2 weeks to come up with the money. Tutu Alicante, executive director of EG Justice, spoke with Ricky Stryak with an update on the case.
Well, what we do know, you know, is that Theodorin, in addition to being the son of the president in Equatorial Guinea, had been previously the minister of agriculture and most recently the vice president. We know what the salaries are for those people in those positions, and there is no way to account for the amount of money that Theodorin has spent in Switzerland, in the U.S., in Brazil, in France, simultaneously around the same period, acquiring private jets, mansions, luxury cars, Michael Jackson memorabilia, et cetera, right? And what we do have also, you know, is the testimony of businessmen from Equatorial Guinea and from Europe, you know, Italians and others, who were extorted, you know, who had to pay revolutionary taxes and whose businesses in some instances were taken away expressly by Theodorin.
Where is Theodorin right now?
Right now, we hope he's in Equatorial Guinea. As I mentioned in a tweet earlier today, the Brazilian carnivals are around the corner. And this is around the time when Theodorin tends to travel to Brazil, or to Trinidad and Tobago and other places in the Caribbean. Theodorin is the vice president, supposedly. You know, so you don't want any government officials to be, you know, doing what government officials are supposed to do, as opposed to, you know, dancing in carnivals with carnavaleros.
Are the French authorities able to enforce this fine with Theodorin allegedly in Equatorial Guinea?
I think the great irony here, you know, is that though there is no need or no requirement for him to spend any time in jail right now, should he be in default, should he refuse to pay this money, he could be facing or he could be looking at any international arrest warrant, right? However, we also know that there is still the possibility of Teodorin and his lawyers appealing this decision to the Supreme Court in France, which we expect them to do in the next 14 days, in which case, yes, he could continue to travel, including to Schengen countries. But once we have a final decision from the Supreme Court, or should they decide not to contest this decision, then clearly Teodorin would have to pay or face an international arrest warrant.
That was Tutu Alicante, Executive Director of EG Justice. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from North Carolina. Daniel Arap Moi, the retired late president of Kenya, will be buried today, Wednesday, at his rural home in Kabarak, Nakuru County. Heads of state from across Africa, diplomats and political leaders are set to attend the burial. Yesterday, Tuesday, an interdenominational state funeral service was held. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, African leaders have praised the late President Moi as a peacemaker in the region.
Thousands of mourners led by political leaders, heads of state and members of the public filled the Nyayo Stadium in Nairobi for the requiem mass of the retired late President Daniel Moi. Speaking in Nairobi yesterday, Tuesday, late Moi's son, Senator Gideon Moi, said that his father was a peace-loving man that brought together East African countries and Kenyans at large for the 24 years he was in power.
Many have talked and written about my father as a statesman, a peacemaker, as a politician, as a leader of men. But today, I stand before you on behalf of my brothers and sisters to talk about the man who was our father. You see, despite the responsibilities of state that he carried on his shoulders every day, he still found time to be a wonderful father. Father, you have fought the good fight and kept the faith. We will miss you.
The President of the Republic of Djibouti, Ismail Omar, has conveyed his message of condolence and stamming Moi as a man who valued the friendship between Kenya and the East African countries and fully participated in matters concerning the region.
President Moi was one of the founding fathers of IGAD. He was a great statesman and one of the biggest Pan-Africanists in this period.
South Sudan's President Salva Kiir, who was among the leaders consulting Moi politically, has celebrated Moi's efforts in ensuring his country gains independence.
To join the Kenyan people in mourning President Moi, whom we consider as the hero of our independence and freedom, the people of South Sudan are heavily touched by the death of President Daniel Arap Moi, who is the icon of peace in our region.
Representing Nigeria, Vice President Yemi Osinbajo said that the late Moi valued the collaboration with other countries across the continent.
He was, as we've heard, very instrumental in the resuscitation of the East African community, along with President Museveni and others. He was also very instrumental in COMESA and even IGAD. These are the precursors of the African Free Trade Continental Area arrangements that we're making today and to which almost every African country has subscribed.
Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta will later today, Wednesday, lead other political leaders across the world in the final journey of the late President Moi, who will be buried at his rural home in Nakuru County. Moi died on 4th of February this year, at the age of 95. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
And that's it for this Wednesday, February 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Bote in Washington.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles. legends and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.